This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 21st of October, as a Met firearms officer is found not guilty of murdering Chris Cabba, who was shot dead during a police stop. We get reaction from the local MP. Also, think small and think practical. Advice from a seasoned American ambassador to the US Secretary of State as he heads back to the Middle East. We speak to a claimant in the largest ever mass lawsuit in England and to a professional women's footballer who's calling on FIFA to drop its sponsorship deal with a Saudi oil company. And as an airport in New Zealand introduces a 3-minute hugging rule, how long should a good hug last? And we begin this evening with the verdict in a murder trial that has major implications, not just for the victim's family and for the defendant, but for the way that this country is policed. That's because the defendant, Martin Blake, was a police firearms officer who had shot dead 24-year-old Chris Cabba during a police stop in South London just over 2 years ago. Today, a jury at the Old Bailey cleared him of murdering the unarmed black man who had been driving a car linked to a shooting the night before and whose death led to protests across the country. Chris Cabba's family sat in silence in court, but a short while after the verdict, they issued this statement.
This decision shows his life and many others like him doesn't matter to the system. Our son deserved better. The acquittal of Martin Blake isn't just a failure for our family, but for all those affected by police violence. Despite this verdict, we won't be silenced. We are deeply grateful to everyone who stood by us and fought for justice. We'll continue fighting for Chris, for justice, and for real change.
Giving his reaction to the verdict, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, acknowledged the wider social context.
Any fatal use of force understandably prompts huge concern amongst communities, particularly in black communities where trust in policing is low. There remains much for us to do to strengthen confidence in our service, and we know incidents like this place further strain on already challenged relationships.
But he went on to praise the work of the Met's firearms officers, and he expressed his concern about how cases like the one against Martin Blake are pursued.
No police officer is above the law, but we have been clear that the system holding police to account is broken. I worry about the lack of support officers face for doing their best. But most of all, I worry for the public. The more we crush the spirit of good officers, the less they can fight crime.
Well, we will get on to what this means for the Metropolitan Police in a moment. But first, the circumstances of Chris Cabba's death. Joining me in the studio, our home editor, Mark Easton. Just remind us, Mark, about those circumstances and what the jury had to base its decision on.
It was really about 17 seconds, the time between a hard stop of a police car that Chris Cabba, of a plane car that Chris Cabba was driving, and the moment when the fatal shot was fired. And they had to consider whether the firearms officers, who they were told have to make split-second decisions, they're under huge pressure, they've got enormous responsibilities, whether that was a lawful act or not. The bullet, as I'm sure you've reported, went through the windscreen of the car and into the forehead of Mr. Cabba, who was unarmed. Now, of course, this took place in the context just 2 years after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And we saw in America, obviously, the Black Lives Matter protests, huge amounts of disruption there, probably the biggest protest since the Civil Rights Movement. And then those also came to the UK, of course. And then this, I think, this killing prompted, in the days and weeks after it, prompted protests here in the UK in a number of cities. And I think in that context, there was a lot of pressure on the prosecution service to pursue this matter. There were questions as to whether this was going to be a George Floyd moment for Britain. And the jury decided in well, only a few hours, actually, that it was not a George Floyd moment for Britain. This was a police officer doing his best in very difficult circumstances.
What then was at stake, and perhaps is at stake, for the Metropolitan Police?
I think if it had gone the other way, I think it would have been catastrophic for a force already deeply scarred by scandals and, of course, accused of institutional racism. So I rather suspect Sir Mark Rowley let out a fairly large sigh of relief when the verdict came in. Indeed, I'm told that such were the concerns, if it had gone the other way, that might have triggered firearms officers to hand in their guns, as they did when their colleague was murdered 2 years ago. I understand the army was again on standby to provide an armed response in the capital if required. As it is, of course, Sir Mark, as you've been listening, is tonight questioning the decision to prosecute Martin Blake in the first place, and there will be questions. In fact, tomorrow's papers, there are questions from some politicians as to whether that prosecution should ever have been brought by the Crown Prosecution Service. But as well as that, of course, you've got very significant community tensions. That statement from Chris Cabba's family, referring to the deep pain of injustice following the acquittal, that has been echoed by campaigners at the vigil this evening and elsewhere. Significant tensions remain. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has said it is imperative the verdict is respected. Right now, there'll be a lot of work going on to try and make sure that things remain calm.
Mark, many thanks. Our Home Editor, Mark Easton, there. Well, let's speak to someone who is closely involved in this case, Bel Ribeiro Addies, the Labour MP for Clapham and Brixton Hill. It's in that constituency that Chris Cabba grew up, and indeed where he was killed as well. Good evening.
Good evening.
What is your reaction to the verdict?
Well, quite rightfully, people are shocked and upset, as they have been since Chris was fatally shot. I think the most important thing for us to remember is that a young man has lost his life, and his family are going to be very disappointed with the verdict today. You've heard their statement. They feel really, really as if they haven't got the justice that they wanted. But the verdict has been given, and I think we have to bear in mind that the CPS did think there was enough evidence for the trial to go forward.
The legal process has happened, though, has it not? Is it important that everyone accepts this verdict?
Well, we do have to accept the verdict, but that doesn't mean that people necessarily have to agree with it. As you said, a legal process has happened. There may be some future legal processes. We still have the inquest to come. I think it's important to acknowledge that also, but also to make the point that this has only been about the third or fourth time that an officer has ever faced such a charge, and no officer has gone to jail. Following the death of someone following police contact. That's not happened. So it's not a common occurrence. And I suppose the idea that officers are at risk from doing their jobs is not necessarily one that will be shared by the community.
But do you think it is a good sign then that this case was pursued, that the CPS decided to press charges?
I think it's right that any time that somebody dies following contact with the police, that it is thoroughly investigated. And in this particular instance, the CPS thought there was enough evidence for it to go not just to trial, but to trial with a murder charge. So they obviously had a very good reason for doing that. If we're going to respect the verdict, we're also going to have to respect the reasons why they put it forward.
Sir Mark Rowley there did acknowledge that there are broader community tensions. What do you think needs to be done then to bring back confidence in the police in those parts of the community which are questioning it?
Well, there's no secret about these tensions. In my particular area, there has been low trust and confidence in policing, and that's been particularly amongst Black communities right across the capital, actually. And you know, the police need to start working with communities as opposed to the situation which we find ourselves in, where People often feel like they're being worked against. And people, particularly young black men, often feel a lot more force than their white counterparts when they make contact with the police. So that is an issue that definitely needs to be resolved.
Would you acknowledge, though, that police officers, firearms officers have particular strains themselves and are working under exceptional pressures in many instances?
Absolutely. They are working under exceptional pressures. They are working in difficult circumstances. But as, investigations and the charges show, no one is above the law. In any profession where something like this happened, where, during an incident, somebody that you'd come in contact with had died, you would expect there to be further questions. I don't think that it's right for us to even state that this shouldn't be the case when it comes to police. And as I've said, it's very, very clear that this rarely happens when it comes to police. As I said, maybe 3 or 4 people have ever faced any sort of charge and no police officer has gone to jail.
Belle Ribeiro Addy, Labour MP for Clapham and Brixton Hill. Thanks very much. And coming up later in the programme.
In women's football, we have been fighting so many years for gender equality, for inclusion and against discrimination. And that means that we can't promote Saudi Aramco.
We'll be hearing from one of the professional women footballers about why she signed a letter denouncing FIFA's sponsorship deal with the Saudi oil giant Aramco. Now, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is due to arrive in Israel shortly on his 11th trip to the Middle East since the Hamas attacks of October the 7th last year, but his first since Israel killed senior leaders of Hezbollah and the leader of Hamas in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar. While he was in the air, there was more evidence that the main focus in the region, though, continues to be on military action and not on diplomacy. Israel has struck more targets in southern Beirut this evening, hours after it claimed to have killed the man in charge of Hezbollah's financial arm in an attack on the Syrian capital, Damascus. President Biden's special envoy, Amos Hochstein, is already in the region trying to secure a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah. He sounded a rather downbeat note in the Lebanese capital earlier today.
This is my 6th or maybe 7th visit to Lebanon in the past year. And while we spent 11 months containing the conflict, we were not able to resolve it. In each of my visits, I cautioned that the situation was urgent and the status quo was not sustainable. We were either going to reach a solution or things were going to escalate out of control. I stood at this very podium, time after time, including as recently as August, and cautioned about the urgency. A resolution was possible, but it was rejected, and the situation has escalated out of control as we feared that it could.
Well, that was President Biden's special envoy, Amos Hochstein, speaking in Beirut. Well, even as the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was preparing to take off for Israel, more issues. The White House said it was deeply disturbed by the leaking of classified intelligence assessing Israel's plans to attack Iran. For a longer view of America's hopes for a diplomatic breakthrough, I've been speaking to Ryan Crocker, who's Dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. Lebanon and Syria, just two of his many ambassadorial postings during a diplomatic career that spanned 4 decades. I asked him, what advice would he give Antony Blinken ahead of his current trip?
Think small and think practical. The recent assassinations and killings of leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas were notable. They don't dramatically alter the fundamental strategic picture.
What about getting a ceasefire in the short term? What are the chances of that, do you think?
Well, I applaud the Biden administration and Secretary Blinken for making this extra effort to come out to the region and see what can be done. It is obviously going to be very difficult. It has been difficult all along. The United States has been trying to broker a ceasefire for many months now without success. And whether that is possible or not, we don't know. But it certainly behooves us, for the sake of the hostages and their families, to try to find out. And for the sake of the Palestinians who have suffered so much in Gaza. But again with the death of Yahya Sinwar, who is now making the decisions in Gaza itself? Does anyone have control over all the guns and the remaining forces that Hamas can still field? One of the costs of this prolonged campaign, I think, has been a decentralization of command and control on the part of Hamas. So even if there was a will at some echelon of the Hamas leadership for a ceasefire, the challenge of making that actually take place on the ground and the release of the hostages take place is even more problematic than it was before.
How should Israel then go about securing its borders in those circumstances, do you think?
Prime Minister Netanyahu has set the bar extremely high, calling for the total defeat of Hamas. I don't see that happening in the short, medium, or long term. And I think that means that Israel is intending a prolonged military occupation of Gaza. And that is likely to take place with an ongoing insurgency.
You said, and this is with regards to Hezbollah, the other front in this war, of course, that Israel should take the win. How would you define a win in the current circumstances?
That Israel has succeeded in eliminating the senior leadership of Hezbollah, both in Beirut, its headquarters, and in the field in the south. It has launched a devastating strike through the booby-trapped walkie-talkies and pagers. And I would hope that that would be sufficient for Israel to declare its primary objective achieved and to be willing to allow the United States and other actors to try to negotiate a ceasefire on the basis of existing UN Security Council resolutions.
If it doesn't take that direction, what are the consequences?
Again, it behooves us all to remember recent history. In 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon to stop PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, rocket and artillery fire and infiltration across the border. That was called Operation Peace for Galilee. That was 42 years ago. 42 years later, we are a very long way for peace for Galilee, with 60,000 Israelis having to evacuate their homes. Hezbollah was born in that occupation. It did not exist before 1982. And it is highly unlikely that the current invasion and occupation is going to put an end to Hezbollah. The best that the U.S. and Israel and friends of peace in the region can hope for, I think, is the cessation of hostilities, acceptance by all parties, say, of Resolution 1701 from 2006, a withdrawal of Israeli forces, an agreement from Hezbollah to cease its firing and its military activities, and then see if we can build from there.
So is Israel just going to have to accept that it has these two organizations on its border, which are decentralized but still have the ability to fire rockets into it and still want its destruction?
Again, it's the art of the possible in the Middle East. And what may be possible would be a ceasefire in Gaza and in South Lebanon. I would hope that Israel would cooperate with the U.S., with the United Nations, with other interested parties in trying to achieve both ceasefires. That will require a suspension of idealistic goals of, again, the total defeat of Hezbollah, of Hamas, and in the north to accept that Hezbollah may be beheaded, but it is by no means dead. It is not going away.
Can I ask you about something else that's been in the news? This leak, alleged leak of U.S. intelligence about Israel's possible response to the Iranian attack on Israel a few weeks ago. How damaging is this potentially?
From what I've seen, there were no new revelations. The substance of these purported leaked documents was already out there in the public domain. It is a concern, of course, that something of such a highly classified nature is leaked. But given that five different nations had access to it, it's going to be extremely hard to pinpoint from where that leak came.
That was the former U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker. A quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this program or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. The main headlines so far on The World Tonight: a Metropolitan Police firearms officer has been found not guilty of murdering an unarmed man he shot in the head in South London. Israeli airstrikes in Beirut have hit branches of a financial institution which Israel says provides funding for Hezbollah. And the luxury department store Harrods says it's in the process of settling more than 250 claims for compensation brought by women who allege historical sexual misconduct by Mohammed Al-Fayed. Now, the government is expected to make welfare reform an important part of its growth agenda. And one area it wants to address is the growing number of people aged between 16 and 64 who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness. The most recent ONS figure for the last quarter of last year is 2.8 million. That's up by 500,000 since 2019. Now, looking ahead to this month's budget, we are interested in hearing from the economically inactive, whether you're out of work on benefits or perhaps you run a business and you simply can't find the workers you need to make your business tick or grow. Just let us know. You can get in touch with us by text on 84844. 10 to 15p is the charge for that. You can also get on in touch via WhatsApp 03700 100 444 or via email world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. Now, the 100 professional women footballers who have signed an open letter to FIFA objecting to its partnership with the Saudi oil giant Aramco certainly don't mince their metaphors. Aramco's sponsorship, the letter begins, is a middle finger to women's football. The footballers, who come from 24 different countries and who have more than 2,300 international caps between them, describe the deal, which gives the state-owned firm the sponsorship rights to the Men's World Cup in 2026 and the Women's World Cup the following year, as a punch in the stomach to their sport. I asked one of the three main footballers behind the letter, the Danish international Sophie Junger Pedersen, why she thought Saudi Aramco is not an appropriate sponsor.
Saudi Aramco is owned by the Saudi state, which is a state that commits human rights violations towards its own people and discriminate a lot against women. There's, for example, still a male guardianship system in place in Saudi Arabia, which makes it an obligation for women to have a male guardian. And then also, as we mentioned in the letter, a lot of women and men, but women, those that we mentioned in the letter, they are imprisoned simply just for promoting or speaking about women's rights and human rights. So this is something that we as female football players can't promote and can't support. In women's football, we have been fighting so many years for gender equality, for inclusion and against discrimination. And we stand very strong on LGBTQ plus rights. And that means that we can't promote Saudi Aramco.
What then do you say to the argument that FIFA makes, I think, which is that by putting so much money into women's football, Saudi Aramco will be increasing the availability of it, increasing its profile, and will be helping women from all countries?
Well, I think we need to ask ourselves what we want to be part of, and we need to show solidarity with the women of Saudi Arabia. We can't be part of hiding the violations towards women's rights that are taking place in Saudi Arabia. So I'm sure that FIFA can replace this sponsor with other sponsors whose values align more with the values that we stand for.
What would you say to those who would argue that actually women's rights may not be in a healthy position in Saudi Arabia, but they are improving, that the initiative to get more Saudi women into the workforce has seen participation higher than the aims and the goals of the initiative in Saudi Arabia had foreseen, that things are going in the right direction in Saudi Arabia?
Well, according to most human rights organizations, political and civil rights are going in the wrong direction in Saudi Arabia. And I think we have to imagine that we ask Salma al-Shabaab, who's in prison for 27 years simply for retweeting about women's rights, that she should wait a bit because we are moving in the right direction. I just think that these examples are too bad for us, that we just can't promote a situation like this.
Do you think this letter will make any difference? It is not really usual for FIFA to renege on this kind of sponsorship deal, is it?
I always have a positive mindset, and I hope and believe that FIFA will respond to the questions that we ask in the letter. That's really important because we ask what are their thoughts behind this partnership with Saudi Aramco? And I really hope they will listen to us, because we are the ones who are in the forefront when it comes to promoting these sponsors. So I think we have a right to speak up about this.
And if they don't, what next?
Then we will see what happens. We now focus on this letter and hopefully receiving answers from FIFA. And if not, then we will see what the next step should be.
Danish footballer Sophie Junger Pedersen. And we did contact Aramco and FIFA for comment. We haven't heard back from Aramco. FIFA, though, sent us a statement saying it values its partnership with Aramco and its many other commercial and rights partners. If the scale of the disaster was unprecedented in Brazil, so is the court case linked to it that opened at the High Court in London today. 9 years after a dam holding waste materials from an iron ore mine burst near the Brazilian town of Mariana, killing 19 people, 620,000 people and businesses are claiming damages worth up to a total of £36 billion. The civil case against the Anglo-Australian company BHP, which operated the mine in a joint venture with its Brazilian partner Vale, is the largest mass lawsuit in English legal history. Well, earlier I spoke to one of the claimants. Jonathan Knowles lived downstream from the dam with his Brazilian partner and their son Enzo. He lost his business shortly after the dam collapsed and he moved back to the UK. And he took me back to the events of 2015.
News started filtering through that there'd been a mining disaster upriver and that there was going to be a tidal wave coming down the river. To protect the water supply, they were going to turn it off. Day two, we went down to the river to see what was going on. The only way I can describe it to an English person is if you've ever seen the Boar 7, a series of small tidal waves that come down the river. And it was pretty much like that, except these were like thick chocolate soup. And each one was more progressively like thicker as it came down, and lots of debris floating in it. And then as the day went on, people were reporting they'd seen dead cows and horses and other animals coming down the river.
So what were you doing at this point?
So everybody went down. The third day was absolutely biblical. The waves had stopped. The water was completely calm, except you couldn't see the water anymore because it was one mat of fish from one bank of the river to the other bank. And there was every size and shape of fish. I didn't know that a river could support that amount of life. It was just one mat of fish.
And here we are with this huge mass lawsuit. Certainly the numbers of people and businesses involved is eye-watering.
Yes.
And what are you personally looking for? What are you hoping for from this?
So my biggest concern, immediate concern, is the welfare of Enzo. And so we...
And just to be clear, he and his mother, your partner, have moved...
They've now moved here. Shayla brought Enzo to come and visit me in the UK. And while she was here, I pointed out to her about the metal in the air, the metal in the water, and, you know, the poisoning. And I had rather a good argument set out to show to her that Enzo possibly wouldn't survive intact as, you know, without some mental or other repercussions from the pollution. And I said, whereas elderly people like her mother and father, possibly ourselves even, the effects of consuming products with heavy metals in might not kick in until we're the point of kicking the bucket anyway. But with a young person, they're definitely going to feel those side effects.
Jonathan Knowles, who experienced the effects of that dam collapse at close range. Well, let's speak to our correspondent, Ione Wells, who's in Brazil for us. And Ione, you have been to the site of the Mariana Dam, haven't you? Tell us, how is the place there and how are the people there affected by the disaster 9 years on?
Well, one of the major towns that was affected was Bento Rodriguez, which is still completely destroyed. When you walk through it now, it's just like a kind of ghost town. All the houses are covered in mud still from 9 years ago. The windows are shattered, still have sort of television sofas lying around covered in mud all over the streets. So it's really quite sort of apocalyptic when you walk around there. In the wider area, though, people are, to different extents, kind of rebuilding their lives. The companies themselves have set up a foundation called the Hanover Foundation, which is meant to try and compensate some of the people who were affected. And they've rebuilt a sort of new city up in the hills, quite a different feel, though, to the city that was destroyed. It's much more modern. It's up in the hills as opposed to a sort of rural community on the lake. So some people have chosen to move there into some of these new modern homes. Some, though, feel like they still want really the life that they had before. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that some of them are particularly keen to be part of this lawsuit, because they feel like justice hasn't really yet been done in some cases with such a different sort of type of lifestyle being offered to them. And of course, so much lost in the process.
Yes. Talk us through, why has this civil case ended up in a courtroom thousands of miles away here in London?
Well, part of it is time. There is a Brazilian legal process underway, but it has, of course, been 9 years, nearly a decade on, and people are still sort of trying to get different forms of compensation. So I think part of it was a frustration at how long the process in Brazil was taking. The companies, though, say that through this foundation they've set up, they've already dispersed more than $7.7 billion in repair work in the area, but also some compensation to individuals as well, with about 50% of that being paid directly to people who are affected. So the people behind the lawsuit, really, it's a combination of individuals, some companies that lost their livelihoods, some local politicians, authorities as well, collectively essentially saying that they don't feel the compensation offered so far has been enough, and that they also don't feel the company has accepted responsibility for what's happened, because the companies haven't accepted liability, even though they have said that they have been sort of paying out compensation over the last couple of years. Interestingly, though, the reason it was decided to be held in London was partly because that was where BHP, one of the companies, was headquartered at the time. There's a separate lawsuit going on that will start in the Netherlands against Vale, the other mining company involved. Both companies have agreed that if either of them is found liable, they'll split the cost of that. But if they are found liable and if they have to end up paying out damages, it's estimated this could be incredibly expensive for the company, billions and billions of dollars on top of what they have already paid out. So they are arguing that this lawsuit is unnecessary and that it duplicates matters that are already being done in Brazil. But I think the feeling on the ground is, why has it taken so long in some of our cases, and is the type of compensation we're being offered really what we want? That's certainly the view that some I spoke to mentioned to me.
A lot at stake. Ione Wells in Brazil, thanks very much. Many people have extolled the virtue of an airport hug, including this fictional Prime Minister.
Whenever I get gloomy with the state of the world, I think about the arrivals gate at Heathrow Airport. General opinion's starting to make out that we live in a world of hatred and greed. But I don't see that. Seems to me that love is everywhere. Often it's not particularly dignified or newsworthy, but it's always there. Fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, husbands and wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, old friends.
Hugh Grant, of course, at the beginning of Love Actually. Well, the management at one airport in New Zealand appear to have decided that when it comes to departures, there's a bit too much love around. To keep traffic flowing, Dunedin Airport has now limited hugs at the drop-off area to 3 minutes. Fonder farewells, the sign there says, are directed to the car park. Well, Daniel De Bono is the airport's CEO.
There's only so much space we have in that drop-off area, and if too many people are spending too much time with their fonder farewells in the drop-off zone, there's no space left for others. Interesting fact, I did some reading on this a few weeks ago. It turns out you need 20 seconds. 20 seconds to get the oxytocin and the serotonin release from a hug. Anything less, you don't get that. You don't get the happy hormones, and anything longer, I guess, you probably maybe get into the awkward territory.
Well, is he right about the science? Michael Banisi is head of psychological science at the University of Bristol. He's the author of When We Touch, Handshakes, Hugs, High Fives, and the New Science Behind Why Touch Matters. And he's been telling me about the science of the airport embrace.
hugs can be really important to bring comfort and regulate our stress levels. So you can see changes in stress hormones. If people are hugged, it can reduce that before stresses. But they also can impact things like our immune system function. And of course, they play a role in just forming and maintaining social relationships that are really important for our health and well-being throughout our life.
Is there an optimal time for a hug?
There's some studies showing that you can have a too brief hug. So if you have it for 1 second or so, that's a bit too short. There are some studies showing that 10 to 20 seconds can be a really good amount. But then I'm pretty sure we might imagine a scenario where there might be a too long hug, right? If someone's just holding us and not letting go. So although science hasn't quite pinned down that exact time just yet, there's certainly nuances to it.
So what do you make of this 3-minute limit that's been put on hugging at the airport in New Zealand?
Technically speaking, if we look at how hugs can impact our well-being and our stress responses, the hormones that get released can be released within minutes, to be honest. So technically, they're probably giving people enough time. But I suppose realistically, there's also an element that our experiences of touch, you know, hugs included, are influenced by context, right? And so in this sense, putting a time pressure on it could well, for some people, lead to them to feel quite stressed, quite anxious. That may then counteract some of those benefits that we might see from hugging.
So the mere fact of having this time limit could counteract any of the benefits we're getting from the warm hug goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, potentially. I mean, there's different. I mean, there's no science on it yet, right? Nobody's done any studies to look at these airport restrictions on hugs. But in principle, you know, we know that your hugs. You know, if you want to have hugs to have that will have a supportive benefit, they need to feel natural. They need to feel not pressured, right? So in that context, there is that risk.
Well, interesting. You've talked, I think, more generally though about this notion of touch hunger, that we we're hungry for the touch of other human beings. Where does that come from? Is it in that context, is it slightly worrying that touching or hugging time might be limited?
Yeah, well, touch hunger basically refers to a situation when we as people aren't getting enough touch in our lives. So we're not getting the touch that we want in our lives. And actually, if you look at this over the years, like a lot of people think about this in relation to the pandemic, but even before the pandemic, about 40 to 45% of people were reporting this. It went up during pandemic restrictions. And the consequences of this are things like connected to increased loneliness. It's connected to poorer mental health outcomes. So it does have negative impacts.
Michael Banisi, Head of Psychological Science at the University of Bristol. Our closing headline tonight. The family of a man shot dead by police in South London have said they feel the deep pain of injustice after an armed officer was found not guilty of his murder. A jury at the Old Bailey took around 3 hours to clear Martin Blake, who said he had fired at Chris Cabba as he believed one of his colleagues could be killed. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow with a virtual hug over the airwaves. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Thank you, James. We look forward to that. The editor tonight was Matthew Symington. Studio direction was by Charlotte Hadroy-Tojimska. In a moment, we've cocktails and an explosive document as we continue our book of bedtime.
I'm James Gallagher and I'm back on BBC Radio 4 with Inside Health.
If we were looking at your overall brain health based on this, we'd give you a score of 74 out of 100.
Is 74 good?
74 is good, yeah.
Just checking.
We're looking at pioneering technology that's changing the lives of children with rare genetic diseases.
We get results back within 2 or 3 weeks that enable us to make a diagnosis, and in some children offer life-saving treatment immediately.
I'll also be exploring the challenges of finding effective treatments for dementia and asking, how much do the shoes we wear affect our bodies? Inside Health is on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Tuesday mornings at 9:30.
Now, as promised, we continue our book of bedtime as an experimental government time travel project begins to develop unforeseen and dangerous consequences. The reader is Aoife Hines, and this episode contains some strong language.
The Ministry of Time by Callian Bradley, Episode 6. In the new year, the Ministry admitted Graham into the Field Agent Training Programme. It's better that we continue to work closely with 1847, Adela said, given that he seems likely to survive the year. Lieutenant Cardigham, 1645, was also retraining for the field. I should have developed tinnitus from the alarm bells. Why were the ministry so interested in making Graham and Cardigham field-worthy? But all I heard was that Graham was staying. "I'm going to take Maggie clubbing," I announced one afternoon. Graham and I were in the kitchen, flicking through a cookbook. "Very good. I'm not sure whether to warn her of your bad influence or warn you of hers." Margaret, alone of the expats, had tried to develop a circle of friends outside the ministry, mostly people she met through apps I'd never heard of. We planned our clubbing outing with military precision. Margaret had learned the grammar of the mirror selfie and sent me a dozen photos of different outfits. We arranged to have a drink with Arthur and Graham in Dalston first, a situation so 21st century, I felt proud of their progress. Margaret and Arthur were already drinking when Graham and I arrived. "Look here," Margaret lifted a cocktail. "'Tis known as Sex on the Beach. I must assume it is a potion to summon its namesake." "Well," I said, sitting down, "it's made with cranberry juice, which is supposed to be good for UTIs, which is what you're going to get if you have sex on an English beach." "UTI?" asked Margaret. 47, sit down. Stop rubbing at your temples with that malodorous expression. 65, Graham demanded. "Where are the rest of your clothes?" I started to laugh, a real happy laugh. Margaret leant towards me, grinning, and I saw Graham catch Arthur's eye and roll his. Everyone was held in the moment, captured in a small and easy joy. I return again and again to this memory. It's proof, you see. Not everything I did was wrong. Graham's admission to the field agent programme was marked by a small ceremony for the new recruits in a Westminster courtyard. At the bark of a man in epaulettes, I saw Graham, light glinting from the polished brim of his cap, standing to attention, sword at his waist, shiny black shoes. I wish I could tell you how it felt to see him. "Don't turn around," hissed a familiar voice behind me. I flinched so hard that my shoulder blades almost met. "I said don't turn around." "I didn't. Jesus, Quentin, where the fuck have you been?" "Put your hands behind you," he whispered into the back of my head. "Take this, carefully. Do not lose it." He pressed what felt like a piece of card into my hands and I pushed it into my bag. An imperceptible shift and he was beside me. His cheek was streaked with what I assumed was psoriasis, and his chin was grizzled with a strange patchy stubble. "You look tired," I muttered. This stuff on my face throws off the recognition software. "What's going on?" I asked. "Has Genghis Khan broken through the time door from the past or something?" "Not the past. I don't think from the past. What have you been told about the time door?" "None of your business, as far as I recall." There was a noise like a snapping wishbone, and he pitched forward. I caught him instinctively as beside me a woman started screaming a single word like a broken fire alarm. "Gun! Gun! Gun!" Blood was spurting from Quentin's temple, brilliantly crimson. Then he slid to the ground and screams rose up all around me. Everyone was running in a crouch, covering their heads. I wiped red matter off my cheek and lumbered forwards. Quentin died at the scene, I was told. I was the last person to speak to him before he was killed, so I was questioned for hours. One of the officers let slip that there had been a CCTV malfunction and the entire courtyard was unmonitored for the duration of the ceremony. When I got home, I was curdling with exhaustion. I shut the front door and Graham came out of the kitchen, chased by whiffs of slow-cooked tomato broth, garlic and balsamic vinegar. "Are you hungry?" he asked lightly. I got onto the floor, very slowly, and wept. He stood over me for a few moments, then awkwardly squatted down beside me. "Cigarette?" He lit two between his lips, then lifted my chin and poked one into my mouth. He settled back against the wall, and we smoked, Me through tears, he through silence. I wiped my nose on my cuffs and croaked. You've seen people die. Am I supposed to feel as if I've thrown up, but on the inside? He looked around for somewhere to ash. My bag was by the door, and he stretched out a leg to hook the strap and drag it closer. It's understandable you're feeling distressed, he said, unzipping my bag. May I use this? He was flourishing a document holder, misshapen from being mashed into my bag. When I nodded distractedly, he tore a strip from the flap and fashioned a small cup for the ash, which he caught just in time. Here, he offered. But I was peering into the document holder. There was a distinctive manila folder in there. It was an incident report, dated 18 months before the time travel project began. When I pulled it out, it detailed a disturbance in a shuttered youth centre in South London. 5 local teenagers had broken in through a window. Neighbours had reported loud music and laughter, then a beam of blue light and screams. According to the report, the police found bodies with massive, bizarre...
Hey, sorry, dass wir hier gerade deinen Podcast unterbrechen. Wir wollten uns nur mal ganz kurz vorstellen.
Wir sind Jamin und Tim vom Podcast Eine Meine, Deine Meinung. Jede Woche diskutieren wir über ein Thema, das uns alle gerade bewegt.
Das Besondere ist aber, wir losen vorher aus, wer dafür und wer dagegen sein muss, um aus der eigenen Meinungsblase rauszukommen. Also zum Beispiel, ist Werbung für einen Podcast in einem anderen Podcast wirklich sinnvoll? Wir haben ausgelost, Tim ist dagegen.
Werbung nervt. Vor allem, wenn du gerade mitten in einem spannenden oder lustigen Podcast steckst, das killt einfach den Flow.
Ich bin dafür. Wenn die Werbung gut gemacht ist und zu dir passt, dann könnte es genau das sein, was du suchst. Und dann entdeckst du vielleicht einen Lieblingspodcast mehr und schon hat sich's gelohnt. Wie erfährst du auch sonst von einem neuen Podcast?
Ja, aber sind wir das, was du suchst?
Wenn du Bock hast, deine eigene Meinung mal herauszufordern, dann hör rein bei Eine Meine, Deine Meinung.
Kurz EMDM.